I'm Chuck Sragi with the UIS Office of Advancement. Today's program is Pandemics and Epidemics, Past and Present. Our guest today is Dr. Donald Graham, Infectious Disease Specialist with the SIU School of Medicine and Springfield Clinic. Let's pass leadership of today's program on to moderator Bill Furry.
Dr. Graham worked for the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta from 1978 to 1980, and he brings a wealth of expertise and knowledge to us today. We're going to jump right into our questions. The first pandemic to reach America's shores probably came with Columbus, compounded by the conquistadors. Their arrival and the diseases they brought caused the deaths of millions. But the first global pandemic touching all continents at the same time was cholera, which arrived in America from Europe in 1832, traveling to the Midwest from Europe during the Black Hawk War. What was distinctive about this infection? Was it viral or bacterial? And why did it take so long to contain and eradicate it from the shores?
The cholera outbreak was one of the worst because it causes such sudden illness. It causes a loss of body fluids, chiefly through diarrhea, and it allows the blood pressure to drop to such a low level that it can't be sustained. So the patients become weak and they finally collapse and die. Unfortunately, one of the big problems was the sanitation or the lack thereof. The Mississippi River steamer in which families were traveling in steerage with animals. So if ever you had a chance for disease to spread, you're going to see the excrement of the animals and the humans are going to mix. And this is the kind of social situation that led to the development of cholera. Cholera is caused by a bacteria. It has spread in waves throughout the world. There have been numerous pandemics, which means that the disease spreads across the world. And I'll get into that in a little bit about exactly what those mean.
It was spread because of mostly bad water, and it's still recurring all the time right now.
Cholera is still occurring, and it's a model for diseases. The spread is called the fecal-oral spread, which means that the hands become contaminated by feces or by waste products. And then when the person eats, when the person drinks, if the vessel is contaminated in which that food is contained, then the person ingests that, and then it goes into the stomach and then through the intestine and multiplies and causes all of the ravages of the disease.
So the disease could have been cured earlier if people had known about the cause.
It could have been. There's a strategy to cure and a strategy to prevent. The cure of the disease is very difficult. And in fact, that particular disease usually has to run its course through the patient. And once you support the patient, he or she will recover. The problem is so many people get it and they don't have the supporting systems. They don't have the fluids. They don't have the IVs. They don't have the hospitals.
Well, it's fascinating. Cholera, of course, came to Illinois in 1832 with the Black Hawk War.
This is a slide showing a map of London, and it's a graphic of where the cases of cholera were occurring in 1849. And you can see they're very closely allied with the Thames River, or the River Thames, which was known then to be quite a contaminated body of water. At that time, that was a source of water. But in the summer, the water dried up, the river dried up, so people had to go to pumps to get their water. There, the pumps and the pump handles became contaminated by people who were seeking water, who was able to track these infections back to a pump on Broad Street. And once you remove that pump, people would not touch this common source and therefore would not be able to become infected.
Fascinating story of John Snow in London and how he was able to identify the source for this cholera. It came to this country in 1832 during the Black Hawk War, but it came from Liverpool, I believe, and it followed the Great Lakes down to Chicago and down the Illinois River and the Mississippi River, and Governor Ninian Edwards died in 1833 from cholera, which is a fascinating part of that. And this is from Coles County, from an epidemic from 1850 and 51, but it shows that cholera was there in Coles County and everywhere else in central Illinois in specific epidemics that came out.
Yes, this is a memorial marker to commemorate those people who died of cholera. It was actually, it was created and installed about the last part of the last century, but it commemorated numerous deaths that occurred in the 1840s and 50s. Cholera has gone through numerous pandemics, and I think we should define what an epidemic and a pandemic are. First of all, we look at infections,
And an infection is the multiplication of a bacterium or a virus or some microorganism in a human being. It can also be another animal. The infection doesn't necessarily cause symptoms. It can be asymptomatic or representation of colonization of the bacteria, or it can be symptomatic or representative of disease. Either way, it can spread. And we're seeing this right now with the COVID outbreak when we see people who are colonized or asymptomatic that spread. When there are expected numbers of infections every year of certain diseases, but when they exceed, when the number of diseases exceeds that expected, that's called an epidemic. And the word epidemic means above the population, demos being the Greek word for the population. And demos or demic is part of the of all of these words you hear. If you look at what the number of diseases that would be expected each year, that would be the endemic, or E-N-D-E-M-I-C, the number of diseases that would be expected. Epidemic is a number greater than expected, and that could be one case in case of polio. We don't expect any polio, so if we see polio here, then we would say that's an epidemic. Well, if the epidemic spreads beyond the other countries, into other countries and across the world, that would be a pandemic. And that is what, of course, we're discussing with the COVID outbreak right now. But it occurred earlier. Cholera has had numerous pandemics throughout the years. For example, in 1899, an epidemic began in India. It spread across the world. It killed 1.5 million people in a year. There was another wave that began in Indonesia, and that's still going on. And you may have recalled that when we had the earthquakes and the hurricanes that went through Haiti a few years ago, it got a hold, and it is still, we still see some cases of cholera in Haiti. It's caused by a bacteria and then called Vibrio cholera.
The association with pandemics and natural disasters is fascinating to me. We had the earthquake here, the New Madrid earthquake here, but there weren't any people here at the time. But in 1817, there was a huge explosion in Indonesia. The Tambora volcano exploded. And within 5 years, cholera appeared. There's no direct relationship, but there are theories that suggest that the cholera epidemic began with that explosion.
Whenever we have natural disasters, that has actually happened. And I think Haiti's a good example where they had the hurricane and the earthquake. And what happens, you have a disruption of whatever sanitary systems you have. And so the sewers or the gutters where the sewage flows get disrupted. The water supplies become contaminated. There's lack of a natural transfer of travel, so people can't go to town, so they're stuck in certain places, and they start recycling their own waste, in a manner of speaking. One reason why these disasters do lead to epidemics, it certainly is true in war, and in cases of famine and in displacement in Africa and throughout the world, where we see in these displaced persons camps, there are numerous outbreaks of disease in those camps. The Marine Hospital in Staten Island, New York, it was a hospital that was designed for sick persons, but primarily they were patients with yellow fever, cholera, and typhoid, who were immigrants who had come to the United States and were too sick to venture out into the western part of the country where they could start their lives. So they were quarantined and they were treated as much as could be done at that time. There was a backlash on the part of the citizens of New York and no doubt from surrounding areas who felt that those immigrants were causing the spread of disease among their own local people that were already established. So this is an engraving of a woodcut of a picture large mobs who would assemble at the hospital quite regularly to protest the housing of these immigrants.
Fascinating that they put the blame on the immigrants. The next slide.
This is a method of fighting disease. You see the acronym TP, most people understand, that means toilet paper. This was a revolutionary advance. In the lower left-hand corner of that slide is a stack of toilet paper from a drugstore in the central part of the U.S. Well, in 1910, that was a luxury item, but it was a very effective item to allow the cleanliness. And once the patient or the person is clean, there's far less likelihood of spread of the disease because his or her hands are not going to be contaminated.
Basic hygiene is a very effective method of eradicating disease.
Yes.
So cholera was bad, but we've had several other epidemics, pandemics that have come across, come to America. What else do we have that you have investigated?
Smallpox has been legendary. It actually was one of the very first and known to antiquity. Back 1,000 BC in Egypt, there's traces of smallpox. And there have been various pandemics through the years. Here's a photograph of a survivor of smallpox from the state of Ohio in 1902. You can see the pock marks, the pitting in the face of this man. He was one of the lucky 67% who survived smallpox. One third of people who developed smallpox died. And a lot of people don't realize that our President Abraham Lincoln had smallpox back in the time of the Gettysburg Address. He was a lucky person who survived. Smallpox has been famous in the United States even before we were a country. The very first medical article was written in 1677 describing smallpox. Smallpox is spread around the world. You can see some patterns here. It's a map of the world, or at least the Western Hemisphere and part of Europe, showing the green, which is the spread of smallpox, starting in 1617. And then later, there were expeditions of people who would take out smallpox vaccine to try to serve as in a form of missionary work to go to the New World to try to stop the spread of smallpox.
Here's another slide about smallpox in the last century. This is injections for inoculations against smallpox in Nigeria.
We now have a good way to control smallpox, and in fact, we've eradicated it. And I think it's a great coincidence that the smallpox eradication campaign really took up steam just before the founding of UIS. You see, in 1967, the implementation of the jet injector gun allowed the immunization of literally hundreds of thousands and millions of people against smallpox. And they were able to close in on a disease. And the last case that would ever occurred was in Somalia in 1977. The world was declared free of smallpox 2 years later because that was a potential incubation period for some smoldering case. So now we are free of smallpox. And of course, we hope that will happen with others because this is a major way to control epidemics and pandemics. Another outbreak we had was yellow fever back in, we see this in Africa and South America now, but we had it quite commonly in the United States. And this is a little bulletin from 1793 when Benjamin Rush, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, in fact, the only physician who signed the Declaration of Independence, was instrumental in helping bring an end to that outbreak. Over 4,000 people died in Philadelphia. It gradually ended, and Rush, rightly so, deserves credit for that.
I may be mistaken, but a lot of us believe that yellow fever is caused by mosquitoes or mosquito-borne illness, but so it actually has another transmission.
Mosquitoes are the vector. Mosquitoes carry the virus, and the virus is the actual cause. It's it's called a flavivirus. The reason people call the disease yellow fever is the patient actually turns yellow. They become jaundiced because it primarily affects the liver. The way they get it is that a mosquito, the Aedes aegypti, is infected by the virus, and the mosquito is not affected by it. The mosquito is asymptomatic. The mosquito is colonized. He then carries it to a human, bites the human, takes a blood meal, as it's called, and then injects the virus into under the skin of the human, and the human then becomes ill.
Can humans transmit it?
Only through a blood transfusion.
Only through a transfusion.
But not from speaking, not like a respiratory virus, for example. Now, there are other ways to fight disease, and that is antitoxin. We can fight disease by trying to prevent it. We can fight disease by trying to cure it with an antibiotic, and we can also fight it with an antibody or an antitoxin. What happens with diphtheria, which is a disease of the throat and can be fatal, is that you develop these large membranes that cover the back of the throat. It's caused by a bacteria. The bacteria then engenders in the human an antibody response or an antitoxin. Well, one way to fight it is to give the human these antibodies. And you may recall that President Trump was just in the hospital getting antibodies to help fight his infection. Well, back in 1910, this was done, but the source of the antibody then was a horse because we needed large volumes and the horses were quite compliant with the recommendation that they donate. So here is a laboratory at Eli Lilly in Indianapolis where this horse has consented to donate his serum.
Thank goodness for the horse's consent. A question, how has immunization worked to contain pandemics? What's the track record?
Some diseases are very susceptible to immunization and others are not. And one of the best examples is smallpox. There is a vaccine that goes back to the idea of inoculation, even as far back as 1700 in Turkey, for example. The wife of the British ambassador recognized that one of the strategies to prevent smallpox was to take the contents of the pox, the pus that was on the skin of patients, and then take a little bit of that and inoculate that in the skin of someone who has never had it, and therefore providing immunity. That got refined, and through the work of Jenner, and primarily of Jenner, we now have a good vaccine for smallpox. It also, so that definitely has brought an end to the pandemic. When you look at diphtheria, we've developed a vaccine. That didn't occur, though, until the 1930s. So we had diphtheria fighting with toxin before that. Influenza is something that we would like to fight and have been able to fight in recent years, but we didn't even know it was caused by a virus until the 20s. So we didn't have any vaccines then. Now it's the influenza vaccine is a major strategy to stop pandemics. But for the most part, we don't have good vaccines to stop pandemics. We have to employ other strategies.
I think that was a problem with cholera, too, because they didn't know what caused it. They didn't have a theory of germ transmission.
The cholera went on for centuries before it was realized that the bacteria was a cause.
What exactly is herd immunity, and is it a realistic way to control infection?
Herd immunity refers to the idea that it goes back to the idea of cows, where a large number of cows are susceptible to a disease, and then eventually enough cows get the disease that when the virus or the bacteria comes into the herd, there will be such a low chance that the susceptible cow will become ill that he's basically protected by numbers. It's not really a total protection. It just means that the outbreak is not likely to find, if I'm a cow and I have this illness and I then cough on you, my cough is only going to go 6 feet. But if you're already protected because you've been ill before, you're not going to get it. So my virus and my bacteria is going to die out. So I won't spread it. And that's the idea, that you get enough people who have had the disease or enough people who've had the vaccine that it's not possible for the new person to come in and infect them because they just won't come in contact. It's more of a goal. It's a concept, but it requires large percentages of any population before it can possibly happen. And it's on the order of 80% of a population before you can count on it.
It's kind of a false security though as well, because measles is still around, and we inoculate and we vaccinate, but there's still outbreaks, and people who have not been exposed can still create a epidemic.
I think measles is a good example of why the number 80% is too low. You really need a population immunity closer to 90 or 95% before you can say measles won't spread. We see every year, you see a handful, sometimes a couple hundred cases of measles occur in populations. Usually they're small populations where there are very few immunizations, but they definitely do occur.
Let's talk about the Asian flu pandemic of 1918. It seems to have exploded onto the world overnight. Epidemiologists expected an outbreak of the flu in the years up to World War I, but what sort of perfect storm existed to make it such a killer, both in this country and abroad?
The influenza, which as we now know, but didn't know then, it was caused by a virus. The virus actually changes from year to year with a very slight mutation. And as historians look back from 1918, which of course was one of the most disastrous years of influenza, where even in this country, there were 675,000 people who died, and in the world, there were 50 million people who died. It's estimated that a third of the world became ill. Which is a number that's just too high to count, but back then it was a billion or so, maybe not quite a billion. But what factors occurred were the population who developed influenza was susceptible. They had not encountered that virus before because it had mutated just enough that they were no longer familiar with it. There had been flu every year, But the last previous outbreak was about 30 years earlier in the 1880s. Well, the population had grown up, so we had such a large young population that was susceptible. And as you may recall, some of the worst victims, the most likely victims of the flu, were young soldiers. And I think we lost as many soldiers to flu as we did to combat. And that because those soldiers were not immune. They had no protection because they had never encountered the virus in their lives. Over the next, and then if you look back 30 years before 1880, there was another huge outbreak or pandemic. So what it takes is a susceptible population and a virus that has enough lethality or enough morbidity to it that it will cause damage. If it's just a cold virus, it's not going to do anything.
What's this slide we have?
This slide shows that the capacity, the medical capacity in the United States and indeed the whole world was exceeded. So hospitals were too full. They had to start going elsewhere to house their patients. And this was a gymnasium in Ames, Iowa, at Iowa State University, where you can see a row upon row of patients who had influenza. The separation was nothing more than an elevated sheet that was about 4 feet high. That was all across the country, such makeshift hospitals were developed.
We were talking about that in the early parts of the COVID pandemic when like places like Soldier Field were converted into makeshift hospitals.
Soldier Field was, and even Central Park in New York had a number of tents that were set up by the through the city and the state health department with Doctors Without Borders actually came and helped them with that. We've had a periodicity of flu. It never completely goes away. It seems to go into hibernation. And it comes out about every generation in a more severe form. But another interesting point is that the in those days, the diseases were all named by the source of the flu. We had a Russian flu. We had an Asian flu. We had a Hong Kong flu. You may recall that we had a New Jersey flu when we had the H1N1, the A New Jersey, it was called. That name didn't catch on too much. That is why you see some people trying to name diseases as to where they think the case began. The flu in 1918 was also known as the Spanish flu. But it turns out that that was not the only place it occurred. It really was not the origin of the flu. It does cast aspersions then upon the geography where the name gets linked, so that we don't like to use that.
In the new book, I think it's John Barry who wrote the new book about the pandemic, he even suggests that some parts of that Spanish flu were incubated in barracks in Nebraska. I think he was a comment about that, that it had, there was a index case there.
There were quite a few cases linked to the soldiers, the trainee soldiers who were getting ready to go to World War I. Nebraska and Kansas, even some that went up to Chicago, where the training ground is now, that now has been converted into a luxury subdivision on the north side of Chicago. That time, it was an incubating ground. One of the methods we have of control of influenza, this was in 1918, these very stalwart citizens who are trying their best to protect us against flu. I will point out, however, for the benefit of those who are very strict interpreters, that the third person from the left, the woman with the mask below her nose, would not pass muster. So she should be sure to be reminded to put that mask above her nose. This is a poster from Chicago saying that influenza, not only is influenza bad, but influenza then can lead to pneumonia as a complication of influenza. And that actually was one of the major reasons that the patients died, because the influenza would reduce their defenses locally in the lung. So when a standard bacteria came along that ordinarily wouldn't be harmful, it could then multiply and cause pneumonia and actually kill them. We mentioned the pandemics here. There's a time lapse between the major pandemics and then the naturally occurring disease. If we follow the same kind of expectation, we did have the H1N1 flu in 2009, which is a major outbreak. We might expect to have another major influenza pandemic with a brand new virus that might come in the year 2030. You should know how dangerous a sneeze is. This was an amazing technical feat done at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology using a 1/30,000th of a second shutter speed to see what a sneeze looked like, almost in suspended animation. And you could see that the sneeze moves very rapidly at 100 miles per hour. You would get a ticket for that. And it's one reason now I think we should consider giving a ticket to people who sneeze in public onto someone else, because it's just as dangerous as traveling 100 miles an hour. The content of the sneeze is also quite remarkable. There's 4,500 droplets, each of which can contain a virus or maybe more than one viral particle on the surface of the droplet. And a very forceful sneeze can propel up to 12 feet. The idea of covering yourself with your elbow like this for a sneeze, you could see really is not going to be very effective. If you're going to do such a thing, at least turn around. Or better yet, if you're a sneezing type, just don't go to that place.
Well, what stopped the influenza pandemic? Did we reach herd immunity or did the virus just fizzle out? Are there vestiges of the virus around today?
What stopped the pandemic of 1918 was a couple of factors. One was, we call this exhausting the susceptibles. Most of the young troops had already become ill and there were no more troops to become ill. The end of the war helped because then you sent them home and they weren't in the crowded barracks. There were no vaccines. There was no antibiotic, no antiviral medication. In a form, although we don't know the exact numbers, we know that at least a third of the people were ill. In certain areas, there were more than that. And then the spreading, the social distancing was very important, even back in 1918.
You have some masks up here, these N95 masks. And the next slide shows these N95 masks being cleaned or decontaminated through hydrogen peroxide. Is that what it is?
It is hydrogen peroxide. The slide that's up now shows paper bags marked individually with the names of nurses and other employees at a long-term care facility. Each person, when he or she walks into the room, walks into the building, collects the mask that has dried overnight. But after a certain time, they can potentially become contaminated. So then they are either you get a new one or you can put them in a decontamination facility, which is a closed chamber that has mist hydrogen peroxide that will then kill the virus. And they steam them more or less for an overnight period, and then they're clean and decontaminated and ready to use again with no damage to the mask itself.
At one time in the COVID, the first few months of the COVID, the N95 were considered the specialty masks that everybody wanted to get, and they weren't available. So are they still considered to be the best of the bunch?
They are the best filter. What that means is that 95% of the particles are filtered. They're tight-fitting. They don't allow air to come around the edges if they're fitted properly. And you should have a fit test, and hospitals and nursing homes do this before they start to use them for their employees. They are very effective. However, they were readily available before the current COVID pandemic, but because of the number of people being exposed on a daily basis, they quickly consumed all the supplies. They used to cost about 75 cents each. Then the price went up to about $5, and then they were just unavailable. That's why some strategies of cleaning were developed. Now there have been better manufacturing. There's been a good response, but it took a few months to do.
We're going to move on to plagues right now and talk a little bit about plagues, because most of us heard about the plague, the bubonic plague, and the pneumonic is what you call it, the pneumonic plague?
Yes.
Ones that were in the 14th, 15th centuries, moved across Europe, 12th century even so. But we all have, we've heard about plagues that are common and contemporary.
We've had pandemics, plague pandemics, which move across the world. The Emperor Justinian in the Byzantine Empire back in the 500, 600 range was besieged by a plague. There were over a million people who died. Some say as many as 50 million people died before that all ended. Then, even before that, there was a plague in the 100 era in the Roman Empire. But in the 13th, 14th century, we had the Great Plague, known also as the Black Death. It continued for hundreds of years. And here's a London woodcut of showing people exiting the community, the whole city trying to get out of town because they thought the plague was being spread there. And indeed it was. At that time, a plague was one of the first examples of the use of bioweapon warfare. The Mongols in Genoa back in the 1300s actually hurled deceased victims of a plague over the walls of Genoa to try to contaminate the citizens, and therefore they would give up. Plague, however, is still here. We had a big outbreak in Chinatown in San Francisco. Plague Commission was developed to help fight it. They did eradicate it. What we learned then was rats and other rodents carry plague. And so if you get rid of them, they're not going to carry plague. But plague still occurs even in this country. New Mexico seems to be the source right now. Not as many cases, though, just a handful of cases every year.
So it took roughly 600 years for people to identify where the source of the plague came from.
Yes, it did. Well, the rats were suspected. You know the Pied Piper of Hamelin Town. The rats were suspected, and with good reason. Proof took several hundred more years.
Let's move on to you have the modern plague of Ebola, which is still of great concern on the African continent.
It is a scourge, and it keeps popping up. It's presently, again, under some wraps.
Let's talk about polio, because that's the first pandemic that I was aware of as a child, that people were actually contracting this, and there were measures being taken in Springfield at the time and elsewhere around the country, I'm sure, to mitigate any kind of effects from the disease.
Polio, the poster child or the poster citizen for polio was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who developed polio as a, he was a rising star in the in American, New York and American politics. Unfortunately, he developed polio in 1921. He was treated, there wasn't much of a treatment, but he went for rest and convalescence to Warm Springs, Georgia. The thought being the Warm Springs would help restore circulation to the legs. And one of the ravages of polio is to affect the muscles, the nerves that serve the muscles in the legs, and they become so weak that the patient can't walk. And that was Roosevelt's problem, although he had some great braces. Well, here he is showing standing with the help of crutches with some children who are there. But Warm Springs had thousands of patients who had polio. It was an awful disease. Some of the patients had to be in iron lungs because the polio would ascend into the respiratory muscles and then they couldn't breathe. So this lung would breathe on the outside. It would be like a bellows pushing against the lung constantly to allow the exchange of air.
Was it a pandemic or just an epidemic, or was there another word that you would use?
It definitely was a pandemic in that it spread around the world. It was a disease, and in fact, we still have a few cases in the world now, but it spread across the country for sure. It seemed to be seasonal, more likely to occur in the summer. One of the ways to fight it was to give public information about it. And the March of Dimes was a group that did that. They were requesting a 10-cent contribution, and they said that if we get enough dimes, these people were going to march. So you have a little boy in 1945, 45, 46 was the poster child, one of the first ideas of a poster child. And then in 1955, you have this girl who's on the right who also had polio. That was the same year we developed the vaccine, and that was one of the major strategies, in fact, the most effective strategy against polio.
The on-screen question, do you know anyone who had polio? We have 64% say yes, 36% say no. Fascinating. I don't know. I know a couple people in Springfield who had polio, or I didn't grow up with them, but I know them from their adulthood. Is it virtually eradicated now? Is polio gone?
It is eradicated in the U.S. and most of the well-developed countries. There still are cases now and then that occur in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It is some national organizations, international organizations such as the Rotary have mounted great campaigns to help eradicate it, and they're very close.
Let's move on to the COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 has many relatives. Can you trace them to a ground zero virus from which all current strains are derived?
COVID, first of all, COVID means coronavirus. It, strictly speaking, would be capital C, small o, and then capital V. That's coronavirus. The ID is infectious disease. So it's a disease caused by the coronavirus. And the word 19 means that this was recognized in the year 2019. The official name, though, it has a prefix called SARS-CoV. It's SARS-CoV-2. SARS stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. That was recognized in China about 2002, and it spread quite rapidly through China, and it made a little bit of an inroad in the United States and Canada and throughout the world, but really not much. That was caused by a coronavirus. It seemed to be calmed down. Then there was another one like it called the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome that occurred about 6 or 8 years later, starting in Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, caused by a slightly related coronavirus. Now we have the SARS-CoV-2. Now, what is a coronavirus? A coronavirus, first of all, a virus is like a flu. It's like a measles. It's not a bacteria. It is composed of RNA, ribonucleic acid. That's one of the main building blocks that helps engineer your protein in your body. That virus was first recognized as far back as the 20s when an outbreak occurred in a chicken farm in North Dakota. And that appears to be the first time this virus, the coronavirus, recognized. And why is it called a coronavirus? Well, when you look at it in the electron microscope, it looks like a crown. And crown, the Latin word for a crown is corona. So when you look at it in the microscope, it looks like it's a crown with these various projections, like the spikes of a crown, like a Burger King crown, mm-hmm. you might say. There are related viruses that cause the common cold. And there are about 45 different coronaviruses.
Wow. They look remind me of a sweet gum ball, only with red. And they probably have the same properties with clinging to the cells.
They do. Those spikes actually allow the adherence to the respiratory epithelium. That is the lining of the lungs.
What should we be concerned about regarding COVID-19 and the flu virus? How it might manifest in the coming months?
We have already seen the ravages of the coronavirus. We've had 36 million cases in the world of the COVID-19. We've had about 7.5 million in the United States with over 200,000 deaths. So we're deep in the middle of this epidemic. And of course, it's a pandemic because it's around the world. Now, we've seen this and we expect every year we have an influenza outbreak, which occurs around November, December, January, February, sometimes going as late as May, usually not much beyond March. The symptoms of influenza are very similar to the symptoms of the COVID. There's a few differences. Diarrhea is a little more common in the COVID. Nausea and vomiting is a little more common. The loss of sense of taste and smell are certainly, they're very distinctive. That doesn't seem to occur in influenza, and then doesn't seem to occur in much else. But there's so much overlap here. There's also fever and chills. So what happens is if you, the patient, go in to see the doctor, go to the hospital, and you say, I have fever and chills and a cough, well, that used to be in the flu season. Well, maybe that was influenza. Now we have to expand the thoughts of what it might be. We have to do more testing. We have a treatment now for influenza. We don't have a treatment now except for very serious illnesses that require hospitalization, but we don't have an oral treatment for the COVID. So it's going to be hard to differentiate, and some people are going to be treated for both.
What are your concerns as a virologist regarding the race to create a vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, I'm not a virologist as such, although virology, the study of viruses, is something that's very part of the work of somebody who's an infectious disease specialist. But the virologists are the people that spend their times in the laboratory and they're doing electron microscope. They're trying to grow the viruses, trying to understand the mechanics of them. So we depend very much on them to bring us all this information. And what we're learning from the virologist and there are hundreds and thousands of them around the world who are being amazingly imaginative and amazingly productive in understanding what the composition of this virus is. But what they're trying to do is determine a part of the virus that will then engender or create immunity that will not cause disease. So they can take a little piece of that virus and give it to you and cause your system to make antibodies that then will protect you against the new onslaught of the virus. The concerns are that we need to have one that's effective, that one actually does make antibodies. We have to have one that's safe, that doesn't cause any possible side effect, which would range from collapse to anaphylaxis to some kind of neurologic problem, and one that has some reasonable kind of cost. We don't want a $1 million vaccine because no one's going to be able to pay for it. And we want something that's readily available that can be manufactured. I think we have the manufacturing capabilities. I think our pharmaceutical companies are quite skilled at this, and they are developing new techniques all along, and they do this every year with the flu and pneumonia vaccine. What we need to do now is have enough of a population that has been tested to see if the antibodies are formed, and then test them in the field to make sure that once they're exposed to the virus, these people who are vaccinated actually do not get the disease. You want proof of efficacy, it's called. In other words, does it work or does it not?
It won't be a magic bullet no matter what.
It won't be a magic bullet. If you look at all other vaccines, we see that there's a certain vaccine efficacy. There's a certain percentage of effectiveness, but very few vaccines are 100% effective. Some are, like tetanus. Smallpox is probably 100% effective. But flu shots, for example, are not 100% effective. So we're going to have to recognize that this may not be 100% effective.
Do you think the world will be back the way it was before December 2019? Will we have a normalcy that was relevant to what it was a year ago?
I think the world is always changing, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the better. I would love to have a telephone that I could dial. And I think that the absence of a dial telephone is a loss to a certain extent. On the other hand, we have better telephones than ever. I think the biggest problem that the world faces now is the lack of socialization. And I think we have to get back to that. That's such a drastic change in our life that we have to get back to that. And we can suspend this activity for a year or two or three, but eventually we have to recognize how social the human being is.
Dr. Graham, thank you so much for being part of this conversation today about the pandemics and epidemics. The last question that was posed to you, when available, do you plan to get a COVID vaccine? 86% have said yes, 14% said no. Now we can open it up to Q&A. So if you've sent your questions in, we'll have a chance to get to those. Give us just a minute to see what you've sent to us. Let's see. Is there any likelihood that the flu will be much slower in spreading because of less international travel, more mask wearing, and more personal separation? Dr. Graham?
In a word, absolutely. But to expand on that, the approach to control of the COVID back in early March and mid-March was really to shut down all kinds of activities, business, school, any kind of professional and social activities. What we saw then was that respiratory diseases also kind of came to a halt. Now, part of that was because flu naturally kind of drops down in March, but there was an abrupt, almost elimination of influenza in March and April. Likewise, there was a reduction in cases of pneumonia, and there were some side benefits, such as a reduction in traffic accidents because people weren't traveling. So I think that all those control measures, onerous as they were, at least had some benefits.
We have another question, and this one is, I learned when I was pregnant that I did not have immunity for the measles. My mother said all three of us kids had them at the same time. I received the vaccine after birth. The hospital said I had not developed the immunity. How does someone not have immunity and others do? And is this something similar to what's been said about COVID, that some may get it again?
It's a complex question about the measles immunity. First of all, the maternal report that three children had measles may not be completely accurate. We like to think that our mothers know everything, but there is a distant memory here of 20, 30, 40 years, whatever time this was, that the memory may not quite have been accurate. One way to test whether the person has immunity is to do a blood test to look for antibody to measles. And that actually turns out to be a little more reliable than maternal or paternal memory. It appears that this person did not pass that test, that her antibody test was not antibody was not detectable, and therefore she received the vaccine. Now, without knowing all the specifics, I would say that people who are pregnant or in the immediate aftermath of pregnancy do not have as robust an immune response to vaccines and other type stresses as they do when they're not pregnant and not in the immediate postpartum period. So it could be that the response that was measured was at a time when the vaccine would not have been as effective. It's also possible that the timing of the measurement was a little early and not enough time was allowed between the administration of the vaccine and the measurement of the antibody. And then there's the possibility that the vaccine did not work. I mentioned earlier, flu does not work in every case. It has anywhere from 40 to 70% efficacy. Measles vaccine as a single dose does not provide lasting immunity, and that's why even now we recommend a double dose, that is early, about 15 months or so, and then again at 5 years, for everyone. If this person's vaccine was only her first in life, then she's probably going to need a second dose anyway.
Our next question, how common were linen masks during the early plague, i.e. the Black Plague?
Linen masks were available to some people who had the wherewithal to make them. Linen had a certain cost, and you had to have the skill to be a to sew them. And I think I had a picture of a person with a mask back in the 1600s during the plague.
Yeah, towards the end, maybe the last slide in the series.
Last slide, okay. Then the number of people who wore masks, though, I couldn't tell you how many did wear a mask. They were common enough that they became the subject of popular art.
And yet people didn't know what the causes of the Black Plague were, so wearing masks was something that maybe specific physicians, alchemists used to wear simply because they didn't want to be spreaders, I guess.
Yes, there were two reasons. The mask protects you from spreading it yourself, and it protects you from contracting it from someone else.
Do we have another question, Maggie? Is West Nile virus increasing?
West Nile virus had the potential to be a pandemic, but it seems to spread so slowly that it, and it's a seasonal condition, first recognized in the East Coast of the United States about 15, 20 years ago. In a park, actually. People who patronize a park where there's some birds who had West Nile virus were contracting the illness. And then each year it would spread a little bit further west, a couple hundred miles to the west. It hit Illinois maybe in the mid to early 2000 decade. We would see it increased, but we're talking about 1,000 or so cases a year. If you look at influenza and COVID, of course, you have 1,000 times that number.
Another question we have, over 6,000 researchers and practitioners have now signed the Great Barrington Declaration saying lockdowns and government mandates are causing more harm than good and urging a focus on the vulnerable population while reopening. What is your position on this?
I haven't read the Great Barrington Declaration, and I'd like to see it. That seems like it could be a good summary, but I'm sure there's more to it than that. But anytime you fight a disease, you want to look at the people who are most likely to get it. And I think at the beginning of the COVID outbreak, we really didn't know who was most likely to get it. We've learned a lot, and we've learned that there are vulnerable people, the people who have the elderly, the obese, the people with diabetes, the people with bad cardiovascular disease, They seem to suffer the ravages far more than people who aren't in those categories. So we are concentrating on that group. We're also concentrating on protective activities. We encourage the use of masks, and some say, as you see happened back in 1918, you were fined if you didn't wear a mask. We haven't come that far, but maybe we should. But we have protective strategies that we're concentrating on the vulnerable populations, those people who are in crowds. What we haven't done is close all the bars. That's where the biggest outbreak have been lately, but we haven't closed them, and maybe we will. I don't know what the Great Barrington Declaration says about going to bars or going to such places as the cornhole tournament in Taylorville, where there are a lot of cases that were transferred. So I'm all for concentrating our resources on the vulnerable population and the population at risk.
That said, there are a lot of people with diabetes. There are a lot of people with heart disease. There are a lot of people with autoimmune disorders. That's a great part of the population. So people with even pre-existing conditions.
You know, it's interesting that at the early part of the outbreak, the group of citizens of the United States, the residents of the United States, who are most likely to get COVID were the elderly. Now they aren't. It's the middle-aged people, the 20s to 40s, are the people most likely to get COVID. And I think the diabetics are more common in the elderly. Of course, there are diabetics at all ages. But the people who were most affected at the beginning seem to have gotten the message. And we'd like the message to go out to everyone.
Thank you, Dr. Graham. And thank you all for being part of this discussion today and for being audience for the first of our Lunch and Learn virtual series. Thank you so much for joining us today, and have a great weekend.